First of all, let me acknowledge our funder for this, the CDC, and then my colleagues, Steve Albert, who the university who's did the data analysis, my excellent editor and colleague, Dr. Nowak, and Dr. Jonas, who did some of the qualitative work and the predecessor. Farouk here, who has been our project officer and a very capable and pleasant colleague in this. Well, we hardly need to say, after what's been said already, that primary care has also been slow to implement standing order practices for vaccination against influenza of adults, despite the fact that there are as CDC has estimated, 36,000 deaths in a typical year due to flu, and as this audience is well aware, despite the fact that immunization rates in adults are modest and that racial disparity has occurred. So our objective is to prevent this kind of scenario from the 1918 pandemic, to identify primary care physicians' perceptions of barriers to adoption and implementation of standing order protocols. We used a couple of stage process to develop our questionnaire, and we did it by first doing qualitative methods to give us a sense of what we should ask. We did that with three focus groups of primary care clinicians and providers, and those focus groups included physicians and nursing personnel. We also then did 8 in-depth interviews with managers or thought leaders, from a health plan personnel to physicians in charge of a network to office nurse who managed the change in vaccines in her practice. Theoretically, we use the awareness to adherence model. And you may be aware of this model. It's a stage of change model, but it's been specifically used for physician adoption of vaccines. And so the stages are the physician aware of the recommendation? Do they agree with it because they're not likely to use it unless they agree? Do they adopt it? Do they say they've incorporated? And then are they staying in use of it? Are they adhering, in other words? So it's somewhat similar, if you're familiar with DiClemente and Prochaska's stages of change as applied to smoking, for instance, where somebody's smoking and are they thinking about quitting? Are they ready to quit? They need supports. If they have quit, are they in maintenance? Do they need maintenance things? So in a very similar way, this is a stage of change theory, but towards physicians with vaccine recommendations. So we used the qualitative data and the awareness adherence model to create 22 closed-end questions for a national survey. We, of course, included demographics, practice characteristics, the awareness to adherence questions, barriers to and facilitators of standing orders, and we used some of these specifically from the different focus groups and in-depth interviews, and then we added some attitudinal questions. The physicians came from the AMA list, the master list of physicians in the country, and we stratified it by specialty, looking at two specialties, outpatient physicians first of all, but the two specialties, internal medicine and family medicine. Because we assumed a 50% response rate, we sampled to account for that, and in looking for more of 800 respondents, so we sampled double that, 1,600, and we evenly split that among general internists and family physicians. We, thanks to Dr. Ahmed's here suggestion, we used a cover letter that was on CDC letterhead. We stapled a $5 bill to it. We gave a self-addressed stamped envelope to come back to the University of Pittsburgh, and we mailed them out. Then we mailed a second wave, and then we telephoned non-respondents to both waves. For our data analysis, I want you to pay attention to how we group things, because a lot of our analysis are based on this grouping. So we categorized the physicians who responded into 4 groups, and I think they're mutually exclusive. That is, they had no standing orders, and they had no interest in them whatsoever. They had standing orders, but they were interested, no standing orders, but they were interested, maybe. They were using standing orders, but not consistently. And they used consistent use of standing orders all the time for adult immunizations. Excuse me, I'm silencing my phone. Should have done that earlier. In our regression models, then, we compared some of these four groups. The receptivity to standing orders among non-users, and so that would be the first two, comparing 2 and 1. Then our second was consistent use versus all others, so that's group 4 versus the other 3. And then among those who are solo physicians, we did that same, consistent use versus all others. So here's our response rate. For a physician survey, 67%. So let me take you down the tree. So we started with 1,600 physicians, and we found approximately 123 to be ineligible or undeliverable. Some of these physicians were hospitalists. We tried to get them with general internists and outpatient practice, but some of them had switched to be hospitalists. Some had retired or were deceased. Then when that leaves us 1,500, and of those 1,500, we have just over 1,000 respondents and 500 who either refused or didn't respond. And for these purposes, those who didn't refuse, we considered non-respondents. So, and I shouldn't say sample in the top, that 1,015 should actually be, those are our respondents. A little more than we anticipated, because we were hoping for 800, got 1,000. We then, showing you the breakdown, 500 in family medicine and slightly less in internal medicine. Among those, 8% of the family physicians do not offer immunization on site compared to 15% of the general internists. And that is a statistically significant difference. Some of them did not complete the questionnaire. Physicians don't always follow directions. So a few didn't, and so we had about 20 dropouts, and that left for our using consistent standing orders or other things, and we had about the consistent ones, 224 in the family medicine versus 154 internal medicine, and again, a small but statistically significant difference of 46% versus 39. When you look at this issue of standing orders, and because of these specialty differences in respondent, we looked at them weighted versus unweighted overall. And as you can see up in the corner, if you weight, you get 42.3%. If you don't weight, you get 42.4%. We considered a 0.1% difference trivial, and therefore we did not weight any other analysis because it was obvious, it's only 0.1% different. So here along the top of our slide, we see the physician characteristics in the four groups. We're going to come back to that same four groups that I pointed out earlier. No standing orders and no plans. The standing orders are not planned, but would like them. Use of them inconsistently or use of them consistently. And there is a small difference in specialty, as you would expect from what I just shared earlier. And then we get into the issue of awareness. And here you see a real stepwise thing. From 36% in those who do not use standing orders and no plans, stepping up to 71%, and statistically, actually highly significant, I think it's 0.001 if I was to show you the entire details. Agreement with standing orders, again, the stepwise progression up from 51 to 81%, and that's, again, that's a 30% difference. This isn't a trivial 2 or 3%. You're seeing a 30% difference. And so this issue of awareness and agreement in these analyses are important. As we look now at the practice characteristics, we see that being a solo physician, there's a small difference, 33%. And this time I'm just going to give you the numbers in the no standing orders, no plans column. And I'm going to compare that for the sake of brevity to the standing orders consistently used. So you see 33% versus 22%. There we go. So 33 versus 22, that's difference. Do they have two or more helpers per provider? So two medical assistants or two nurses per provider. And that's not very common. 13%, but 23% if they're consistently used. What's the training of their primary assistant? Two-thirds have an MA in the no standing order group, 58%, small difference in the consistent. And this is actually hopeful for me. And while there's a 11% difference in here, this suggests to me that you can do standing orders even if you have a medical assistant as the primary backup. So actually we could say this is pretty good news. Teamwork. Well, everybody thinks they do well, I guess. 70% here, you go over, it's 83%. And so there is a little difference perception. Open to innovation, we get a 20% difference between this, so we're getting a little larger. Do you have an immunization champion? Only 24% versus 34%. And again, I would somewhat look at this as the glass is half full. That without a immunization champion in two-thirds of them, they still could use them consistently. And so I would look at this as somewhat hopeful instead of a half-empty glass. And here is another big difference in the issue of the EMR. And here you see 39% versus 59%, a 20% difference. So now we'll move to regression that attempts to control for things like the number of physicians in the practice type. And we see that internal medicine versus family medicine, that internal medicine, the odds are less, the family medicine, the odds are higher of interest in them. Awareness is a borderline significance. Here you have in the dark the 2-point now, and the agreement is very important. And again, to say this outcome is interest versus no interest among those who are non-users. And this is highly statistically significant. So this is one of the things that I want to point out that we really need to work on is this issue of agreement. Clinical support. Here we can't change that, but two helpers does appear to make a difference. It's not as large statistically, but that is a nice odds ratio of 2.6. And less for some of the other things. The EMR, the electronic medical record, again comes up. Immunization champion does not. So let's move on and look at the correlates of use. So now we're going to use of standing orders consistently versus the others. And here we have, again, a small specialty difference, but here's where the big thing is. Awareness and agreement. Again, two helpers per provider, better staffing appears also to make a difference. And again, if you look at the things with an odds ratio of 2 to 3, there's three items. Here they are. There are some other things. When you look for associations, you can find them, but openness to change, teamwork, the electronic medical record, and an immunization champion were all significant as well. But those odds ratios are less than 2. So they're statistically significant, but not as powerful. Looking at, for instance, a 40% increase in use for an odds ratio of 1.4, not nearly the same as a 2.5 odds ratio. And then we restricted our analysis to say, let's just look at solo physicians. Is it different among solo physicians against physicians in multi-physician practices? And not really. It's actually a little bit encouraging to me as a researcher to see that awareness, agreement, and the number of helpers. Again, those three things, with awareness, with an odds ratio of 2.8, there we go, agreement, 3.3, and support staff, getting that higher level, 2.4, those are our major predictors. Things here, like openness to change, have very similar odds ratios, but because you have fewer physicians in our sample who are solo physicians, the odds ratios are not significant. So let's summarize. Standing order protocol use, awareness, agreement, the clinical support staff, openness to change. That's for use. Among the non-users, but have interest in them, that interest is associated with agreement, with the clinical support, and then the next factor was use of an electronic medical record. So this is a national survey. We had a high response rate for a physician survey. Now, granted, you may get some other surveys that are higher, but for physicians to get 2/3, we were very happy gratified that the physicians would help us. The characteristics of our participants did not differ significantly from the non-respondents. I didn't show you those data, but they're there. The questionnaire was based on a theoretical model designed around physician adoption of vaccines. Of course, this is a survey, and as a survey, it's subject to all the limitations of self-report and is cross-sectional and limited to all the cross-sectional limitations that we know about from EPI. So our conclusions, our standing order programs are underused, but we think they can have a great public health impact. We think that further national efforts at clinician education should be considered. Our next step is we're going to look at pneumococcal vaccine and standing order protocols, and then we're going to develop a toolkit for the use of them. And we're really trying to avoid the temptation. You know, academics have this temptation of creating everything goes in. You know, you put in the kitchen sink idea. You put in everything that every one of your friends and colleagues and every other place in the country has come up with. We're attempting to avoid that, but instead to guide our toolkit on the basis of what we found in the research and on the basis of what will be is evident from other evidence-based information, so that we structure a toolkit that isn't just a come hunt and find what you want, but instead is structured, hopefully for those who are interested but not quite sure about what to do to address the interest issue, and among those who say, yes, I want to adopt them, to then probably stratify by, do you have an EMR or not, and having separate sections for the EMR versus non-EMR users. Because we think that's the way, really, it's going to work in practice. I think we have a little extra time, and I have two other things I'd like to bring up before turning this back over to our moderator. The first is a cautionary note, which I'm not supposed to end on, so I won't as a speaker. But the cautionary note is there's a publication that I was made aware of recently in my own discipline's literature about a minimalist attempt to use standing orders. So they basically shipped out to some practices that said, we're willing to look at what you ship us, standing order protocol information. And they didn't have much of an impact. And I think if you go back, you've got this issue of, we have a theoretical model in our work. It said, okay, aware. These practices were aware. Agreed. They agreed. And that was part of the study, to agree. But it was a minimalist intervention. And I'm not sure that they got really from agreement to adoption, or at least to adherence, because the outcome was very minimal. And so a minimalist approach to standing orders results in minimal results. And so that's my cautionary note. And like a good speaker, I dropped my notes on the floor. So if you'll permit me, I'm going to grab my notes because there's one other thing I want to share. And that's something I didn't know we'd have the extra time to share. And that is to look at what some of the barriers are from our survey. Because we also looked at barriers. I didn't present a slide. I didn't think we'd have time. But I want to give you the top barriers. And these occur in the group that is not, has no standing orders and no plans. So here's the top barriers. 22%, insufficient staff. 22%, workflow. They have problems in how their office workflow is. 26%, resource limitations. Another 26%, physician preference for doing it himself. I'll decide. We, among physicians, we joke, we call that MD-ity. You know, they want to be in control. We want to be in control of everything. And the one that really surprised me the most, I wasn't surprised about MD-ity. We joke about it too much. Fear of malpractice by 17%. And I thought that the word about the vaccine injury compensation program would have gotten out and penetrated, but obviously, or at least allayed fears, but either the word hasn't got out or it hasn't allayed the fears. And it's only 17%, but it still struck me. Those do not add to 100, they add over 100, because you could give more than one response. So with that, I appreciate your time, and I'll turn it back over to our moderator.
Do we now have questions?
I'm Paul Hunter from Milwaukee. I'm new into public health, and I'm a family physician. Since August, I've been in charge of writing and revising the standing medical orders for the City of Milwaukee Health Department for immunizations and STDs. And I didn't have experience before this with using standing orders for immunizations in practice. And I was basically taking over a very well-established standing order protocol that is very detailed. And in looking at, for example, the standing order sets that are available on immunize.org, those seem extremely minimal compared to what we use at the City of Milwaukee Health Department. And I'm not having had experience in using in clinical practice standing order sets. I'm just wondering, is what is used, excuse me, in most practices in between there, or do most outpatient offices use something like the minimal standing orders that are on immunize.org?
That's a great question, Paul, and I'm not sure I have the answer. I can give you some anecdotal things. I think it's generally probably more in the minimalist. I do practice in an inner city in a fairly qualified health center, and we do use standing orders, and we have a policy manual about office policy procedures. And in that policy manual is, and I don't remember if it's 2 pages or 4 pages, but there is a section on standing immunization protocols that we do update periodically. So we do have it in our official policy manual, where if we ever get reviewed by some accrediting organization as an FQHC, we can point to a policy of where it is. But I'd like to take this opportunity to speak for us how it works in one inner city, fairly qualified health center that is really short on resources. And we're blessed with an EMR, which at times is a blessing, and at times people say is a curse, but it's really been useful for our documentation. And we have programmed it to, when we have a nursing note started, so when an MA or an RN starts the note, vital signs come up. And in that, below the vital signs, it asks the question, are immunizations up to date? So that's a prompting. And then what it does, using a pull technology, is it will pull in the vaccination dates for adults for influenza, pneumococcal, and tetanus Tdap vaccines and place them in front of the nurse. So the nurse, as she's entering, or medical assistant entering blood pressure, et cetera, is faced with this prompt, vaccines up to date, and is faced with the list of current vaccines, at least for these three. And when we have standing order protocols, they're empowered. And so it's really a pleasure to walk in and to see a Band-Aid on the patient's arm. And I can say that it works, and what's nice about it is if I'm running behind, I can walk in and see a Band-Aid on the arm and know, well, it's one thing I don't have to address, it's already taken care of.
I'm Paul Dew. I'm the medical director for the Kansas City Health Department Clinics And I'm a little surprised that only 17% of the responses was related to physician liability. So specifically, are physicians who signed those standing orders ultimately held liable for any serious adverse effects? And also, are you aware of any lawsuits related to this?
I have not studied, is there any litigation out there against physicians for either use of or lack of use of standing orders. I'm not familiar with any litigation on that. I don't have comparative data to say whether that's high or low. I was surprised, to me, I felt so reassured by the decade plus of vaccine injury compensation program information that to me, I was surprised it was 17%, not 7.
I'm Gina Carpenter. I'm an RN with an immunization program at a federally qualified health center through Indian Health Service in Alaska. And I appreciate these physicians' comments and concerns because from the RN point of view, if we are operating under standing orders, are we covered if we don't have a physician's signature in the EHR, and how do you handle that at your health center? Do you have your standing orders literally in your EHR?
The standing order protocol is in the nursing, well, it's in the standard operating procedure notebook. I don't know all of our internal website, our internal servers, but I'm pretty sure most of all those policy books are also, if you knew where to look on our web server, or on our server, you'd be able to find them because they're all typed, they're not handwritten. We do not have physicians sign off on the vaccines, actual administration. There's no physician sign off because it's, as far as legally we're concerned, it's signed off by the policy manual. Mm-hmm. That policy manual empowers our nurses to vaccinate by protocol. So there's no, I don't sign off on those flu shots. The only place I sign off is I have to sign off because we haven't been the best at policing our revenue streams. I have to sign off on all procedures done for billing purposes. And that's not so much to sign off that they are done as to prompt both the nurse and I. We actually both have to sign off on them to make sure that we don't miss stuff and we don't drop charges inadvertently. So it's actually not it's a policy to protect us from dropping charges that we should be covering.
Okay. Do you do children's immunizations and do you have any standing orders for infant immunizations?
We do, our pediatrician does most of those standing order, most of those. Influenza vaccine can be given by protocol, as mm-hmm. can, I believe, adolescent vaccines. I don't know that if we have actually done that with preschool vaccines. Mm-hmm. I think we've limited that to adolescent and adult vaccines, but I'd have to double check our policy manual to just to make sure.
Because it'd be interesting from the state public health point of view, where as a state medical director, they're signing standing orders for public health nurses to be in remote locations doing infant immunizations. And I'm just wondering what the difference is if you're not under the state system, but, you know, say under a federal system, why that can't also apply. But I'm finding that it might not apply and that nurses in those federal institutions might have more liability because there aren't standing orders for infant immunizations. Do you know anything about how that works?
I'm gonna have to say I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
I just wanted to ask if you were starting to see any standing orders for walk-in immunization policies in ambulatory settings.
Our standing order protocols apply whether they're walk-in or not. Whatever their policies, the issue on for us for walk-ins is, do we have the nursing personnel available time-wise? And we try during influenza vaccination season to do that within certain time restraints to have the ability of people to walk in. We do not offer that 5 days a week, you know, all days, but we do have set hours that we try to allow walk-ins, and it occurs under the same policy.
The toolkit that you mentioned, what components are going to be included in it, and what is your timeline for that?
The timeline for making the toolkit? If I understood right, the time question was the timeline for the toolkit? Well, to be determined what's included in it, our process will be, we will develop it, we will try to use the results of our survey to guide a toolkit that is not just, a kitchen sink of everything we can find on the web. As you know, and has been mentioned here already, there are a number of standing order examples, and they go back at least a decade, that are available either in, because I have them on my shelf from a print, bound print that was done by a company about a decade ago, to many places that have examples of standing orders on the web. So our goal is to create something a little more, shall we say, organized than the ones that we have seen before, because they're already available. There's no point in creating what's available freely on the web that you could Google now. The question is, what can we take that would be the next step? And so I think ours will be, we will segment the audience into what part of the segments, you know, where are they starting at? Because if they already want standing orders, there may not be a lot of purpose in discussing why do standing orders. So we'll try to segment it. Our timeline is this calendar year. And I don't want to say more than that because I know my own limitations, and I know that we're also doing this in collaboration with colleagues at CDC, and I don't want to make any promises that I can't keep on either side. You have other thoughts on time?
Well, once we have the standing orders, I mean, it will be posted on the University of Pittsburgh website, as well as links to other websites like immunize.org that we plan to have.
Actually, we're going to put them so they're easier to find on www.immunizationed.org/standing orders. So we've already kind of identified a site to house them.